very good evening to you and welcome to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM. You're warmly welcome to our programme on this first Sunday of May as we celebrate this holiday weekend. Father Jerry Kenny here in the chair this evening. And on our programme tonight, I'm very happy to have as our special guest, Father King, a native of Kilkee. Father has done tremendous work over the past 20 or so years, bringing documentaries to RTE television in a series called What in the World, where he examines through the lens of his camera some of the social justice issues in many countries throughout our world. We'll be hearing from Father in a few moments, but first, little music. Here is Alton and The Gap of Dreams.
Thank you.
You're tuned to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM on this Sunday evening of the Maybank holiday weekend. And I'm very happy to be joined online now by Pather King. Pather, who's a native of Kilkee here in West Clare, grew up in the townland of Kildeema. One of 10 children, he attended Bantry National School, St. Flannan's College in Ennis, St. Patrick's College Maynooth and UCG. He taught in vocational schools in County Clare and for the past 20 years or so has been particularly involved in working on documentaries and as a filmmaker and as a non-fiction writer. What in the World is a series that was broadcast by RTE Television, and to date he has filmed in over 50 countries across Africa, Asia, the Americas. He has published books, his latest book being War, Suffering and the Struggle for Human Rights. Pather, you're very welcome to join us here on Clare FM this evening.
Thank you very much, Derry. Thanks for the invitation.
Pather, when I read what you have written and the documentary, view the documentaries that you've done for RTE Television, what strikes me is that you have an enormous passion for this work and for the whole question of documenting, I suppose, civil rights and human rights and their infringement in all of your work. Where do you think the seed for that particular passion of yours came from?
Gosh, that's a difficult opening question. I think it's a complex question as well. It's really difficult to distill down what are the key influences in any person's life. I think if you're asked me to that, if you were to ask me that question tomorrow, you might get a very different answer. But certainly there are key strands in one's life that you can identify as being somewhat influential. And the home I grew up in was certainly that. It was a house where politics was discussed a lot. It was Civil War politics. It was a house where I suppose my father was very active in Fine Gael. He was a big supporter of Frank Taylor's, was involved in the Measta Common. And when relatives would come, politics would always be discussed. Very adversarial politics, very nationalistic based. It was, we were the Collins people, the Lenans next door were the Dev people. You could actually plot the whole neighbourhood in those days, and you could identify each house as belonging to one of those two blocks. There was very little Labour politics awareness in West Clare, although Kinross, interestingly, was quite different. There was quite a strong Labour tradition, and that probably has to do with the docks and Kappa and so on. So that certainly was one influence. I suppose Ireland at the time in the 1960s was, I think as we all appreciate, a deeply, deeply conservative society. So it's not surprising in a way that we were locked into that kind of binary world of you're either right or wrong, and there was a complete absence of any greyness or any nuances in that world. And then I went to boarding school in St. Flannan's College in Ennis, and obviously, you know, people's experience of that school varies. I really saw it as a tough place for a youngster to be. For me, it was a cold, harsh place, pretty unforgiving in many ways. Although I readily acknowledge that wasn't everybody's experience, and many others would take a very different view. But one of the things that I felt it had going for it was really, really good teachers. And I think we were really blessed with some of the very, very fine teachers. Lee Mash has become a longtime collaborator of mine. Was just superb. Reuben Butler taught me English, was, you know, a really, really excellent teacher. Very wry sense of humour, very, very engaging. And then Pat Malone, who preceded you in the parish in Kilkee, he taught us geography, taught me geography. And in many ways, looking back at it, I often see him as a very conventional priest. I mean, he played golf, which most priests did in those days. But he had a real passion for Latin America, and he opened up that world in a way that was very, very influential. He was the first person we heard talking about Che Guevara. He was the first person I heard talking about Simón de Bolívar, after whom the country is named. And of course, the official name for Venezuela now is
the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, the official name given to Venezuela by its then President Hugo Chavez in 1999.
I remember Pat Malone talking about were the silver mines in Potosí. Potosí is the highest city in Latin America, the highest city in the world, in fact. And years later, I went there and made a documentary. And I really think that my going to Potosí to make a documentary was directly linked to the kind of world that was opened up for me as a 15, 16-year-old in St. Flannan's College in Ennis. And I had a real sense of, when I was there, of just the images that were presented to us in the classroom at that stage. I mean, this shows our age, or certainly my age, but you had these old Gestetners photocopiers, which were blobs of ink, really. And what he had were images of tiny insect-type people climbing up this enormous mountain, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And initially, life expectancy for the miners there was 6 months. That was the life expectancy during the Spanish conquistador era. Now it's a little bit longer, obviously, but still everybody who enters into that mine knows that their lives are being shortened. So I mean, that's maybe a long way of answering a question. But yeah, if I were to point to two, I would say growing up in a house where politics was debated, and those kind of very critical interventions during your teenage years, which are very formative years, that they certainly were influenced. And I one of the things I really regret that I never said it to Pat Malone, that there was that linkage. And when he was in Kilkee as well, I always thought that when he preached and when he was sermons, he was very kind of left of centre in his thinking. And I was always really taken by the kind of sermons and that kind of left of centre perspective, which is one that I share clearly. And it differs very much from the kind of, I suppose, conservative politics that I was born into, and one from which I have grown away.
You mentioned there the influence of teachers in particular, and I suppose you carried that with you too, because you've spent quite a number of years teaching in both in the classroom and now, I suppose, sharing your experiences in the documentaries, which is a method of teaching as well, and helping all of us to broaden our perspective on the world in which we live.
Yeah, and even to stay with the schooling for a moment, I remember I was teaching in the comprehensive school in Shannon in 1984, and in 1984 was the year Ronald Reagan came to Ireland. And that was, I often think that was kind of a pivotal year in my own kind of thinking as well, because in that year, in the lead up to Ronald Reagan's visit, there was a huge groundswell of opposition. Because of his policies, particularly in Latin America, but also because of his nuclear policies. And there was this really broad coalition of people. So you had returned missionaries, you had trade unions, you had women's groups, you had left-wing parties, and people that you wouldn't normally see coalescing around a particular issue. And I remember being in Shannon when Reagan came, and in Galway afterwards, didn't get to Ballyporeen where he was. And that kind of model is one in which I work with still, where you bring people, kind of disparate people in many ways, with different perspectives on a lot of issues, but united around this notion of that we can do better, that we can organise life in a much better way. And in a way, that's been the model of how that kind of left-wing revolution, that what's often referred to as the red tide that swept across Latin America, particularly in the 90s and into the 2000s. So, for example, if you take the Sandinista revolution in 1979, four of the ministers in that left-wing government that overthrew the Somoza dictatorship were priests. So you had Miguel de Scoto, who was the foreign minister, was a Jesuit priest, and then you had the two Cardinal brothers, amazing people, very, very literate, both of them poets, who were members of that government. So that confluence of very, very different perspectives and bringing people together, that was something that I learned in Shannon, learned in the comprehensive school. And one of the great things about the comprehensive school as well, you had a lot of activist teachers who were involved in Amnesty International, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and so on. So it was a really kind of exciting time to be in Shannon at that stage. And of course, Shannon also has that kind of political context in that it hosted a number of Chileans in 1973 after the fall of Salvador Allende. And that too happened because of a priest from Ennis who was working in Chile and who was instrumental in bringing Chilean refugees out of Ireland and into Shannon. And then, of course, in Shannon, you had all the refugees from the north of Ireland as well. So Shannon was a really interesting and also an influential time in my life. And that all centred in 1984 around the visit of Ronald Reagan.
Father, having given us that opening, I suppose, an introduction to your work and to your passion, maybe we might just pause for one of your choices of music now. First piece of music comes to us from Aretha Franklin, if you'd like just to talk us into it, please.
Yeah, since I was a kid, I've been fascinated by the Black Civil Rights Movement. I remember I was 10 years of age when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I remember it well, and I remember when Robert Kennedy was assassinated in June. And I often wonder about, he was this kid from a very rural farming background going to a school in Bansha and been really captivated by the significance of that moment. You know, it's a whole history that I've really immersed myself in and read and feel drawn to again and again and again. And, you know,
in the context of the George Floyd execution,
I think most people in Ireland and most people in the Western world are now really cognizant of the scale. It's the original sin of the United States. I know that's a very kind of religious way of framing it, but the slave trade, which began in 1619, when 20 slaves came to the United States for the first time. I mean, that has been a blot. That has been, and these people have been terrorized. And the whole kind of story of slavery, the Jim Crow laws, and the civil rights movement, it's an epic story. And it still lives on. I'm really kind of influenced by the work of a woman called Nicole Hannah-Jones, who writes for the New York Times. And she actually founded the 1619 Project. And she coined this slave, or this phrase of slavetocracy. And she describes the United States as a slavetocracy, as something that has never fully dealt with it and has lived with it and is shaped by it. And I think this song by Aretha Franklin is an acknowledgement of that. And also, I absolutely love gospel music and the power of gospel music. And one of the great things and privileges, if you like, of being moving around the world and filming is that I've managed to film in churches, in particularly in the southern part of the United States, where gospel music, and there's a kind of a visceral sense of just deep, deep emotion. And that deep, deep emotion has very, very strong political roots, and very strong political roots in that whole obscenity of slavery. For all of that, and for all that I've learned and engaged with and being just caught up in that world, and also in the day that's in it for the recognition of George Floyd and all the others, Trayvon Martin, we the list goes on and on. And can I just say one last thing on this, that because I referenced Martin Luther King, who died in the 4th of April, 1968. A couple of days afterwards, because I've been reading a history of the Black Panther movement, there was a 17-year-old killed in Los Angeles by the police. He was, and his name is Little Bobby Hutton. His name will never make it in the history books. But I'm kind of taken by his story because it came in the aftermath of Martin Luther King's assassination. It was a direct result of police brutality. He was 17 years of age. He was an idealist. He was out doing some street organizing. And he is just one of the countless numbers of people, African-American people, who have died from white supremacy, from the kind of imperialism that runs right through the United States. So for little Bobby Hutton, I'd love if you played this song.
That's the voice of Aretha Franklin and her version of, very moving version, indeed, of Amazing Grace. You're tuned to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM this Sunday evening. And our guest on our programme this evening is Pather King, documentary and filmmaker and author with a great passion for social justice and human rights in all of his work. Pather, continuing our conversation, I suppose for the past 20 years, the focus of your work has been actually around the world, visiting over 50 countries and documenting in a very unique way, I think, because when you look at the documentaries and you're writing on these, it's not just the normal news gathering presentation of what's happening in the country. It's actually, in some ways, you've touched into the soul of what's happening to people in areas that are war-torn and facing many difficulties. You know, there's a deep sense that we're in conversation with a person on the street and hearing their struggle. What was the experience like for you?
Well, first of all, in terms of when I started out to do this work, My primary objective really was to bring some kind of critique into the dominant economic model that governs the world, or misgoverns the world, which is probably a more appropriate term. So I really wanted to look at what neoliberalism is and how that impacts on poor, disfavored and discriminated and disenfranchised communities right across the world. And I referenced the experience in Bolivia earlier on. So in that context, I wanted to see what the mining industry or the extractive industry, in all its brutality, how that impacts people in terms of their health and economic status and so on. And also to look at who the beneficiaries of that industry are. So I looked at the extractive industries there and in Angola in terms of the oil industry and so on. In terms of, I suppose, and then laterally, as you indicate, I kind of moved more towards the impact of the military-industrial complex, which, of course, is tied to the whole kind of neoliberal agenda, and to see how that has impacted on people. There's a famous a famous warning from the president that preceded John Kennedy, Eisenhower. And when he was leaving office in 1960, he warned against the power of the military-industrial complex. And we see how that now has unfolded over the years through the Vietnam War, through the war in Afghanistan, the war on terror and so on. And what's really interesting is that this year alone, I mean, this figure is staggering, this year alone, the United States will spend $700 billion on its military. $700 billion. So in terms then of where do I fit into that, I suppose I'm always kind of reluctant to engage in that, because I think the role of a journalist, and particularly what I think the role of a foreign correspondent ought to be, is that you're a conduit, you're a messenger. And I think the best conduits and the best journalists that we hear are ones that we don't hear of. Now, there are some kind of notable exceptions, and I'm not putting myself in the same company as people like Robert Fisk or whatever. But Fisk never promoted himself. And there are others as well, like Fergal Keane, who's got strong Ennis connections. He's married to a woman from Ennis, and others as well. So I think that what our job is to do is to try and report on how the poor of the world, the voices we never hear, those who are beyond that kind of celebrity culture or celebrity mindset, that our job is purely to report on that and to get into one's own kinds of personal observations on that, or to talk about, you know, the risks that one may or may not make in bringing these stories. I'm I understand that people ask me that question because out of concern for my safety and concern for the safety of those who work for us. But it's a, and this answer sounds like a long time explaining why I don't want to answer that question. But so sorry if that's if that's not quite what you were asking me.
That's okay, Father, that's okay. But I suppose what is interesting me when I read through all of the encounters you had, and, you know, the humanity that is in every page of what you write, maybe it's just as a curious question, Father, perhaps, but the fact that you were Irish going into these countries, did that in some way open doors, or, you know, was it an influence in helping people to accept what you were doing in recording their story?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I actually think we are Irish people think of ourselves very much in exceptional terms. And I kind of worry about that or wonder about that. I mean, we do think that, you know, how there is a kind of a narrative in Ireland of how we've saved the world. I think we have a slightly disproportionate sense of our own importance in the world or our own role in the world.
I'm smiling, Pather, because in some way you're echoing what a very good friend of mine in New York always says to me. He says, I can't understand how you Irish, you always seem to punch above your weight, you know, and you've left your footprints everywhere for a small country. But I suppose maybe what I'm really searching about is, prior to you going in there, the influence that Irish people would have had in some of these communities, maybe through the missionary work or through non-governmental agencies or aid workers assisting in some of those countries, did that leave some impact that maybe helped then in what you were following up and recording?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to tell you a story in a moment, but can I preface it first of all by just in the context of what I was saying about the sense we have. I remember we were in Mauritius once, and it was at the height of the Celtic Tiger, and we were stuck where there were roadworks. So we're sitting in the bus, and there are guys working on the roads, and one of them leans in the window and says, where are you from? So we said Ireland. And you kind of begin to kind of puff yourself up a little bit when you say you're Ireland, because the expectation is that you will be affirmed in some way, right? And this guy said to us, Ireland's a really bad place for Africans to be. And, you know, we were completely taken aback by that. We were completely taken aback. And then he began to tell us about his daughter who was living in Dublin and about the really terrible, the racism that she encountered, and but also the thing that he talked about most was the exploitation by landlords of people who had come into the country. So, and I'm now that happened a long time ago, but I'm always reminded of that story and that incident when we begin to think ourselves or conceptualize ourselves in some way as the exception. That's not to say that Irish people's influence has always been in that vein. I mean, there are countless numbers of examples of people who have gone to Latin America and to Africa and who've done extraordinary work. And one of them I want to reference is a man from Cratloe called Jim Crow. It's an unusual name in the sense that we talked about earlier about the Jim Crow laws. And I used to joke him about it. I said, gosh, if your parents only knew, they would have probably come up with Seamus Crow as opposed to Jim Crow. Jim Crow works in Sao Paulo. And he, along with about 20 others, set up the Workers' Party in Sao Paulo. And the Workers' Party is now the biggest left-wing party in all of Latin America. Its leader, who is a personal friend of Jim Crow's, is a guy called Lula da Silva. People who've followed Latin American politics would be familiar with him. And this was long before the right-wing year Bolsonaro came to power. So here you had a priest, member of the Kiltegan Order, very similar to my own background, grew up on a farm in East Clare, goes to a seminary straight from school, and goes out to Sao Paulo and becomes a critically important figure, a critically important figure at a time when you had right-wing dictatorships running the country, and at an enormous personal risk to him. was instrumental in founding a political party that not only elected Lula twice, but his successor, Dilma Rousseff, as well, and has become the biggest political party. And it was really extraordinary. We would not have been able to make... We made a documentary on police violence against black people in Sao Paulo. It would have been impossible to make that film without Jim Crow. I mean, he was the person who opened the doors. Like, we traded on his reputation. And so I went out there for about a week before the film crew arrived to set up the shoot. And so I was going around and meeting people. And, you know, there was a degree of, I won't say hostility, but there was a degree of, who's this white guy coming from Europe to make this film? And what are his intentions and so on? But if Jim was with me, or if the translator who was with me would say he's a friend of Jim Crow's, it just, the dynamic changed immediately. So, I mean, he is one of countless numbers of people that we don't hear about. Now, I know the Clare Champion have done something on Jim Crow, but what I loved about him as well is, so he left Ireland in, I don't know, the late 70s, I suppose. He never lost his East Clare accent. Like you would imagine he comes from the Martin Killinane or someplace in East Clare where Six Mile Bridge or wherever there might be a Mart, and was really unfazed by the connections that he has with people. But he played a profound role in the lives of countless people in Sao Paulo and in Brazil nationally as well. So yeah, and I've been blessed with between people like him, people involved in civil society organisations, the Concerns, the Trokers, Self-Help Africas and so on. So yeah, so it wouldn't have been possible to do that work without those connections and without the goodwill that goes with those connections.
Just to reference the tremendous body of work in the What in the World series that you were part of, you know, instigated for us, Pather. If people want to watch back to any of the series, is it still possible to do that through RTE?
Yeah, if you go onto the RTE player and go into the search bar and just put What in the World in it, series 7 to 12 is on that. The first six series are not on that. But the programme that features Jim Crow that I just mentioned is on it. The Bolivian one isn't. So, yeah, you can access them on the RTE player.
And maybe we'll come back, continue our conversation in a few moments, but let's take another little break from music. And your second choice of music comes to us from Tina Turner.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit like the Desert Island Discs, like you're asked to pick three pieces of music. So, and these came to me very, very quickly because, first of all, change is going to come. It's a really, really positive message. And one I think that we need to hear in COVID times, that, you know, these days will pass. Not suggesting a kind of complacency that will allow us to go back to the way life always was, with the kind of indifference that we had towards the natural world and towards the way in which we relate to each other, not to mention the way we relate to the poorest in the world. But I'm also, it was written in 1963 by Sam Cooke, and it was written, on, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the cusp of the civil rights movement. But I really like Tina Turner's version for three reasons. One is what's not to like about Tina Turner, and the other is if there's a wonderful guitar solo by Robert Cray in it, which is a wonderful piece. And if you ever want to watch this on YouTube and you want to treat yourself to like 5 or 6 minutes or whatever, it's slightly more than your 3 minute piece. If you ever want to treat yourself, it's just a powerful, powerful piece of music. And the interaction between Robert Cray and Tina Turner is simply wonderful. So it's a very affirming song, even in moments of adversity and even in moments of despair or moments of great difficulty and challenge, the notion of change is going to come. And it's interesting that that comes from an oppressed people, that the people, African-Americans who have known oppression, and we've talked about that earlier on, that there is that kind of affirming view of the world. So, yeah, enjoy.
There's an old friend that I once heard say, touched my heart, and it began this way. Just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
Voice of Tina Turner, choice of our guest here this evening, Pather King from Kilkee. Pather, as we've been chatting about your great work in the What in the World series for RTE and the publication of your books on that topic, I'd just like to ask you now about the fact that our world for everyone has changed over the past 12 months or so with the pandemic. To some extent for myself, I felt that maybe because most of our news items now are about the pandemic and about restrictions on ourselves, there's a danger, I sometimes feel, that maybe we become closed in ourselves as part of this pandemic. The news is focused maybe on our own narrow world, and yet most of your work has been about trying to broaden our perspective on the larger world and what's happening there. Have you any reflection for us, Padre, at this stage about how that world that you engaged with prior to the pandemic and its suffering and its struggles, how that will pan out as we come out of this pandemic?
Okay, well, that's another really big and complex question, Jerry. I think, again, trying to distill it down into some kind of component parts that might be possible to get our heads around, I think there are a number of key areas. One is that we tend to think about COVID as an interpersonal or a personal-to-person. But what it shows us is that it goes beyond that. It is about our relationships with nature, or certainly our relationships with animals. Like the view is that COVID, although it's not confirmed, emerged in these wet markets in Wuhan in China. So it is about the relationship between us as a human species and the animal kingdom. It is about us and the physical world, the natural world. The term that people now are using is about the Anthropocene. It's about the totality of relationships between all living organisms, of which we happen just to be one within the world. So once you begin to think in that kind of vast, vast scale, it's very, very difficult for us to comprehend it. So I do think within that, then, if you look at other kind of component parts, one of the key elements I think that it addresses is around food production and how we produced food, food transportation, food consumption. And all of these kind of individual areas will have to be, we really need to think them through again. In addition to that, then, it's about our relationship with the pharma industry, our understanding of patents, our understanding of intellectual knowledge. I mean, the vaccines that have been produced by, you know, the vast majority of the cost has been borne by the public sector. So one of them, and I forget which one of them, was funded by 95% of taxpayers' money. And yet the pharmaceutical companies are claiming ownership and are patenting these. And by patenting them means that they're ring-fencing them, and they're re-fencing them ultimately to drive stakeholder profit. And meanwhile, as you reference with India and with Africa in particular, the people there can't access what have been publicly funded by, for the most part, European and American taxpayers. So there's also that other element in it of the economic injustice of it. There's also that notion of what is it to be private anymore? So that distinction between the private sector and the public sector has fractured completely. And I think that what has given us to realise is the importance of public sector. It also now challenges the notion of work and what is work and what is useful work and how is work valued and how is work remunerated. So now we hear, which is, of course, a terrible irony that, you know, in Britain, for example, in the last budget. So for the last year, you had people, you know, standing outside hospitals, cheering nurses and so on. And, you know, you had moments giving over where everybody stood and clapped. And yet nurses got 1% of a pay rise in the last budget in Britain, which is less than the cost of inflation. So there is that disconnect between the kind of rhetoric that we have brought to this and the policies that are following them. So all of these issues, and these are so big, each individual issue is so big almost to appear insurmountable, but these are the kinds of challenges that we will have to really begin to think about. Not just in the next year, not just in the next 5 years. My guess is in the next decade and even onto the next 50 years. So we have to come over this intellectual dissonance, and there has to be that kind of really rigorous intellectual work that goes on around these issues and conceptualizing them and understanding them. And sometimes, you know, that kind of intellectual work is downgraded and seen as, you know, that is a luxury. I think that kind of engagement at an intellectual level with all of these issues has come center stage because we're asking fundamental and critical questions about What is the world? How do we organise ourselves in the world? Where are the vulnerabilities in the world in terms of ecology and the human? So all of these are now up for discussion and evaluation and thinking through and trying to find ways in which we can live in a way that accommodates all of us. And by all of us, I just don't mean the human population. I mean all living organisms. And if that's not a big task, I don't know what is.
Listening to you, Pather, I think to some extent you are beginning maybe a new season of What in the World. Certainly, it's very important that people like you keep asking the questions, keep broadening our minds, and keep the conversations that you had with the people in so many countries that you visited alive and vibrant for us here in Ireland. And may I wish you every success with that particular work that you do. Your closing piece of music is, I know, is dear to your own heart. Recently, we had the funeral of your dear mum here in Kilkee, and it brought up great memories for you. And this particular version of John McCormack's song was played at her graveside. And we'd like to play it for you, Pather. Thank you for your time and for the work that you do. Maybe if you'd just like to say a few little words to lead us into this particular piece of music from John McCormack.
Yeah, my mother died about 6 weeks ago now, and her birthday will be next week. She would have been 98 next week. You know, like, she's my mother, and we loved her deeply, and she was very democratic with her own love and affection in that she loved us all equally, and we all felt that. And she was a woman of her generation, like her neighbours, they were all women who worked really, really hard, raised big families, and they were of a time. And that old Irish phrase of Níveg a Leheid an a Rísh is certainly the case. She loved music and she loved John McCormack, and she grew up in a house in where they had old 78s. Now, not everybody will know even what a 45 is, not to mention a 78. And that was the one thing that they had. She grew up in a house that didn't have very much, as was the case with the vast majority of people in Ireland in the 1920s and the 1930s. So one of the really moving things, and I just wanted to say this, that the way funerals have changed in Ireland in the last year is really remarkable. And there is something absolutely profound and really beautiful of people standing at crossroads and people standing outside their houses as the hearse drives by. And I was really deeply touched by that. And then afterwards, when we came out, you know, you celebrated the mass for Mam. And when we came out, and there were people lined in pockets outside the church in Kilkee. And so there was something really, really profound about that. And it was a beautiful Sunday as well, I remember. When we were at the grave, her grandson, Chris Storr, who's a fine musician amongst a lot of other things, and he played the concertina, and he played this John McCormack song of When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. And none of it, we're notoriously bad singers in my family, so there was a very kind of low-key and very much off-key version of that song sung. So with thanks for just a wonderful life and all the love and affection that we experienced, all of us, ma'am, this is for you.
There's a tear in your eye, and I'm wondering why, for it never should be there at all. With such power in your smile, sure as dawn you'll beguile, so there's never a teardrop should fall. When your sweet lilting laughter is like some fairy song, and your eyes twinkle bright as can be, you should laugh all the while, and all other times smile, and now smile a smile for me. When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morning spring. In the lilt of Irish laughter, you can hear the angels sing. When Irish hearts
Father, thank you so much for your time, for your contribution, and for the questions you keep asking. Keep us aware of what is in our world.
Thanks very much, Jerry. It was lovely talking to you. Thank you.
If you would like to find out more about Pather's work, then I would refer you to two books that are published by the Liffey Press. The first is What in the World? Political Travels in Africa, Asia and the Americas. And the second book, his most recent one, is War, Suffering and the Struggle for Human Rights, also published by Liffey Press. Both of those books are available in good bookshops or directly from Liffey Press itself. And of course, if you'd like to view the actual film documentaries themselves, then they are available on the RTE Player website under the title What in the World? Well, we're coming near the end of our programme for this Sunday evening. I'd like to thank our special guest, Father King, for joining us in conversation. To you, the listener, I hope that you have an enjoyable holiday weekend. Travel safely. May God protect you over the coming week. And we leave you with the reminder that we will be here at 9 o'clock next Sunday morning for the celebration of Mass on Clare FM. And also next Sunday night, do join us again for Beyond Belief. Until then, slán agus spenacht.